but the city is already coming back to life after months of fierce fighting. A market is open, selling all essential goods, and humanitarian aid is being distributed by organizations associated with the Russian government.
These days, the situation is more or less stabilized. People are fed. There are more problems with water, electricity and gas in some parts, and there are still problems with basic domestic needs.
Amongst the ruins, I came across a gathering who are waiting for a drop-off of humanitarian supplies.
During the fighting, I was at home. When there were battles, the house was shaking. I stood with my back to the wall and I was shaking with the wall. When I think of it, I still shiver. There was nothing good about the fighting. We don't want anything except peace and quiet now.
The population of Mariupol before the war was about 450,000. Now, it's hard to estimate, but we think around a third of those people still remain, either stayed during the battle or stayed nearby the city in camps and have now returned. Over the next days, weeks, months, years, we can expect many thousands of people to return here to Mariupol. But who will be those people? Before the conflict began, the city was very mixed between pro-Russian, Russian-speaking people and more Ukrainian nationalist, pro-Ukrainian people. Now that it's under Russian control, as long as it stays under Russian control, we can expect many of the Russian people to come back. But for the Ukrainians, they may well stay away, which means that the ethnic diversity in the city, the ethnic makeup of the city, will change.
It is not yet time to be happy about anything. But there are certain expectations that Russia is a rich country and its politics are more independent. And we hope things will improve.
How do you feel living under Russian rule now rather than Ukrainian?
You see, we cannot say anything yet. We don't understand anything yet. We only want it to be peaceful and quiet. That's what people want here. What else can we say?
Like many people I speak to in areas recently taken over by Russia, she is scared to answer such questions. She may be more pro-Ukrainian, or she might be worried that Russia might not be in control of Mariupol for long. Down by the port area, I found the incongruous sight of fishermen, seemingly oblivious to the fact that war was still raging across the country.
Of course I am happy. Of course. Truth to tell, we've been waiting for it for a long time. Of course, yes, I'm happy to be under Russian control now, because we have become free. Well, we were free before, but not in this way. The attitude changed. People have a different attitude to each other now. Earlier, we were afraid to say things and speak our minds. Yes, I could get into trouble if I criticized the Ukrainian government.
This is commonly heard amongst Russian speakers here, that they have been marginalized and persecuted by the increasingly nationalist Ukrainian government. This is the reason the East rose up 8 years ago, and why many here welcome the Russians. Unless Ukraine takes back Mariupol, it will now likely be populated predominantly by an ethnic Russian population. Whatever the fate of this city, it will never be the same again. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The controversial idea of creating an EU army has now come to pass in all but name. The European Commission confirmed on Wednesday the bloc's 27 nations have agreed to jointly spend €200 billion on military hardware over the next few years.
Joint procurement is better operationally for our armed forces, because this strengthens the interoperability between the armed forces.
Citizens are struggling to survive, mainly due to the economic fallout from the conflict in Ukraine. But it appears EU authorities have other priorities.
We need modern air defences. We need drones. We need air-to-air refueling capabilities. We need tanks and armoured vehicles. We need coastal defence.
Anti-war demonstrators in Brussels say the extra billions being spent on NATO and the EU army cannot be justified.
Just those people are saying that we have to secure ourselves. Against who? Against what? Against, I don't know.
We want Belgium out of NATO
and to want NATO out of Belgium.
The European Commission insists the EU's military spending plan will complement the work of NATO, not erode it. But military experts are saying that is inevitable, and they say the project has already seriously undermined NATO's credibility. The Commission has also just announced an additional 9 billion euro for the Ukrainian government.
Since the beginning of Russia's aggression on 24th of February, the EU has provided 4.1 billion euros to help Ukraine.
Hard-pressed EU taxpayers might wonder how the money will be spent. Last September, the bloc's financial watchdog revealed how corruption is rife in Ukraine at every level, from the government to the judiciary. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Hamas government media office has held a big ceremony in Gaza to pay tribute to fallen Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank last week. Palestinian journalists, academics, and senior Palestinian officials attended the ceremony. Palestinian officials accused Israeli regime forces of deliberately killing Shirin Abu Akleh.
Shirin was killed in cold blood, like many Palestinian journalists. Israeli forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. We demand that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists.
Abu Akleh was wearing a press vest that identified her as a member of the press when she was shot by Israeli snipers. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, protective gear that clearly indicates individuals are journalists should grant them extra protection, not make them targets.
We demand, and I think the international community should all demand justice for Shirin Abu Akleh. What is happening from the Israeli occupation, the constant targeting of journalists, is just a systematic, ongoing, punitive reaction that keeps on going. It has been going on for so long, and it still is continuing.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Under the Geneva Conventions, journalists, like other civilians, enjoy protection amid armed conflicts.
I believe that, you know, killing Shirin Abu Akleh was not the first crime that the Israeli occupation has committed, and it won't be the last one. I believe that as long as there is a military occupation of the Palestinian territories, these crimes won't stop, especially against Palestinian journalists.
While covering Israeli attacks, Palestinian journalists work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
Observers say that Shirin Abu Akleh's killing is another example of the Israeli regime's brutality against the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
An investigation reveals the immigration agency has collected data on most Americans. It's the latest case in a worrying trend, says Farah Hassan, a foreign policy in focus contributor, in an article published under the heading, ICE is spying on American people. Here's more.
Yeah.
Almost 1,200 innocent people, mostly Muslims, were rounded up and detained after the September 11 attacks, often for months without charges. Arabs and South Asians were racially profiled and deported for minor immigration violations. The FBI began surveilling mosques across America. As part of the Homeland Security reforms following 9/11, the U.S. Congress created the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE agency in 2003 to ostensibly fight terrorism and enforce immigration law. But the truth is, ICE went on to use its newly established authority to spy on nearly everyone across the United States of America. An independent two-year investigation has now revealed that ICE collected data on hundreds of millions of Americans under a legally and ethically questionable surveillance system, largely outside of public oversight. Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology uncovered this dragnet after filing over 200 Freedom of Information Act requests and reviewing ICE's contracting records from 2008 to 2021. In its report released on May 10th, the center found that ICE has spied on most Americans without a warrant and circumvented many state privacy laws, such as those in California. The authors conclude ICE now operates as a domestic surveillance agency. ICE has carried out this surveillance by turning a third parties like state departments of motor vehicles, large utility companies, and private data brokers like LexisNexis Risk Solutions. From these sources, ICE gained access to driver's license data for 3 in 4 adults living in the United States and scanned a third of the license photos with facial recognition technology. ICE is also able to view over 218 million utility customers' records across the U.S., including for over half of California's residents. This surveillance network has unsurprisingly hit immigrant communities hardest. The agency has targeted immigrants for deportation by cruelly exploiting their trust in public institutions, such as when undocumented people apply for a driver's license or sign up for essential utilities like water and electricity. These practices point to an agency that has clearly overstepped its boundaries. ICE does not have the congressional authority to do this kind of bulk data collection on the public. This overreach underscores the need to shift U.S. immigration law away from a deportation-driven status quo. Unfortunately, this ICE program isn't an isolated case. It's part of a broader domestic surveillance apparatus that spans decades and multiple federal agencies, including the FBI, CIA, and NSA, and ultimately impacts all of Americans. During the 1960s and 70s, federal agencies spied on anti-Vietnam War protesters and civil rights leaders. More recently, in 2013, whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed that the National Security Agency created a massive surveillance program that secretly gathered telephone records on millions of Americans, regardless of whether they were suspected of any wrongdoing. And this February, newly declassified documents exposed the CIA's own secret bulk data collection program to spy on Americans. The type of data remains classified, but Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich have called for greater transparency on the agency's surveillance of Americans. Americans should all be alarmed by this growing domestic surveillance state. Left unchecked, it corrodes public trust in U.S. democratic institutions and undermines U.S. civil liberties, most notably the embattled right to privacy. The history of the U.S. regime surveillance demonstrates that Americans can never take this right for granted.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the Ukraine conflict, there have been some major gains made by the Russian army, unlike what is being reported by the Western media. For example, the port city of Mariupol is now under full Russian control. This is while the Ukrainian Prime Minister Zelensky has said only diplomacy can end the war, unlike his partners like the U.S., who just got the green light for another $40 billion in military aid. Meanwhile, the world is suffering from food shortages and record inflation. Well, these are just some of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Political analyst and blogger at The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh, joins us from New York. Also joining us is political analyst Rusia Segodnya from Rustam Safronov, who joins us from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Jim Kavanaugh, taking a look at the military advancements that has been made by Russia. Basically, the siege of the Azovstal is over, and it is reported that Russia is in full control of Mariupol. First of all, why is that deemed to be Russia's biggest victory yet, as it has been described?
Mariupol was the strongest redoubt of the Azov Battalion, who were the most dedicated and vicious fighters on behalf of the Ukrainian, of the Kiev government. And there was an enormous number of fighters that were taken prisoner. I think it was almost 2,500 came out over the past few days and surrendered unconditionally to the Donbas and Russian troops. And that was a surrender, not an evacuation, as the American press presented it. So it demonstrates that, you know, it took a long time. It took longer than maybe that the Russians wanted or thought it would, but the Russians worked methodically for that victory, and it's a big victory, and it's going
Okay, it seems like we may have lost our guest there. Rostam, let me ask you about how this gives Russia the advantage that it was looking for. And not only that, looking at the way that this at this point may then lead Russia to move into the Donbass region as a whole. I'm guessing that that is the next military maneuver or strategy that Russia has. And if so, if it does take over Donbass, does that give an indication that perhaps the war is going to be over? I mean, is that Russia's military objective in this war?
Well, I think it's a minimum what Russia wants to get. That's liberation of Donbass from Ukrainian control and giving how Russia would present that the people of Donbass right to decide their destiny. Do they want to be independent or to be with Russia? But certainly not under Kiev control. Would Russia go further and continue advancing to another areas of Ukraine, trying to occupy, for example, entire coast of the Black Sea? That's remain to be seen. The question is the position of Kiev government. They do not want to give up. They do not recognize Russian rights to control the destiny of Donbass and even don't want to give up on Crimea. All of that making truce in next future impossible. What Mariupol meant, that's a big chunk of military force what Ukraine has, finally was substantially tarnished, diminished, because that so-called die-hard, almost like Ukrainian SS fighters, which used to not supposed to surrender and whatever, they used to be glorified, very dedicated, very much brainwashed with a semi-nationalistic, almost Nazi propaganda. Finally, they have to give up, and it's giving Russia some moral advantage. Okay. I mean, military too, because defense of Azovstal plant was a huge military event and siege of that. And it was distract a lot of Russian forces from advancing to entire area of Donbass. They used to be paralyzed there because, you know, tied up, tangled up. So now it's over and it will help to liberate some forces for further advances. So that's how I'm seeing the situation.
So that's one way of looking at it, Jim Kavanaugh. But the other way that mainly Western media is depicting this, and we're trying to just get to the bottom of what's going on militarily, is that this war has been, or special military operation has been a failure when it comes to Russia. We know, and I'm sure you're familiar with how it's been described as what was supposed to be a lightning conquest, as it's been written. But yet it's been somewhat drawn out, and Russia has been unable to take the capital, Kyiv, seen as a failure and a pullback of forces. But based on what we're seeing today, I mean, that's not a military failure on the part of Russia. Are the online, whether online or any other description of Russia failing military, just meant to hamper and disappoint the Russian morale, so to speak?
Well, it's meant to gin up support in the West and in the United States for a fight that they believe they can win. We have, I think it's the case, and I don't think, you know, I don't want to pretend not to recognize that the things didn't go as quickly as Russia probably thought they would, and that many people who were supporters of the Russian cause here thought it would. But I think that, you know, when you look at the real deep military situation, the Russians are achieving their objectives. And the primary objective wasn't to, the defeat of an enemy doesn't happen because you take cities, it happens because you destroy their military. And this is what the Russians have been methodically doing, destroying the Ukrainian military apparatus from its logistics and its ability to resupply and its communications possibilities, et cetera. And the Russians really want to secure the Donbass republics. They want to secure the coast, and they have been largely successful on that. So the thing that's been happening in the United States is the West is, you know, tactical retreats, changes of position, movements of have been portrayed as Russia's losing. And that has encouraged a lot of people to say, we have to fight, and American politicians, we can fight this to win it, and not only to help Ukraine, but to weaken Russia. I think that's a fantasy and a very dangerous one that is getting us into a very close to a third world war.
All right, now comes one of the key questions that I'm hoping that you can answer, Rustam, and that is how it has been reported that the Azov fighters, of which it has been described to be far right, and perhaps you could expand on that more for us, is said to have had an impact or an effect in this conflict. Please tell us about the Azov fighters, who they are, what does their capture mean, how many numbers there are, and whether the one of the main reasons that Putin went into this special military operation was, as he said, to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. This has been talked about, but now that they have been captured, many of them, tell us what it means in terms of the war.
Well, it used to be a few thousands of fighters of Azov, very elite and very well trained and equipped, not even a detachment, it's almost brigade. So because it was increasing and recruiting new members, and it was very prestigious to serve in that detachment. That were highly motivated military men, volunteers, soldiers, convinced nationalists. A lot of them right now, when they used to be searched during the surrender, have in their body tattoo of the Hitler swastika, pictures of Stepan Bandera. One of those individuals, I think with the name of David Kasatkin or something like that, he had a sign additionally to everything else, to different kind of slogans and words and swastika. He had also signed, kill all of them. So it's like a soldier who was looking at him saying, like, who do you really want to kill? Like, who all, like, whatever, entire people in the face of the earth. So that was very motivated people. And generally speaking, in Ukrainian military forces after 2014, when Russia took over Crimea, new Ukrainian authorities put a lot of emphasis into the nationalistic spirit of Ukrainian army. First of all, they moved from the east all military schools to Lvov, to that area, to Ternopil, Ivano-Frankivsk, to the west. And they inserted special political commissars from the western part of Ukraine, which is traditionally much more nationalistic, into military structure to be able to discipline and boost morale in nationalistic way. So Azov was a core of all of that. That's why Azov was defending biggest city in the area of Donbass, which rebellion republics wasn't able to conquer. So That's why the failure of Azov meant so much. I told you before, it's almost like SS used to be in Nazi Germany.
Right. Azov. Well, that's how it's been described. And Jim Kavanaugh, Ukraine is the world's only nation to actually have this neo-Nazi formation within its military ranks. And again, as our guest there talked about them, they are very capable to earn that. And that is perhaps why the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that they are the ones that are being targeted. But again, the picture that's being painted is not as such when you listen to Western media, that Putin's just out of his mind to even mention this, and that's just some kind of, I don't know, illusion or delusion that the Russian president has. What are your thoughts on the fact that now the arrest of and the death of some of these Azov fighters is a factor in this war?
Well, it is a factor. It's always been a factor. And but your point is valid. I don't know to the extent to which the West and Western media is willing to recognize this. I mean, The Azov Battalion is one of a number of really fascistic battalions, and these are groups, that political groups, that whose legacy goes back to fighting with Hitler in the Second World War, and they're not ashamed of it. They're proud of it, and they boast about it, and they call themselves Nazis. So, and you do have a relationship between, you know, the fascist groups around the world, especially in Europe, look to them, because as you say, this is the only nation in the world where these groups are highly integrated into the state apparatus and the military apparatus, and they've changed the ideological framework and climate of the country since 2014. So, you know, you have groups around the world that look to them for inspiration. The Buffalo shooter in New York, in last week in New York, took his inspiration from the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter, who took his inspiration from the Azov Battalion, whom he visited in Ukraine. And you have the fact that if these groups win, that's going to be an impetus, and it's going to be an inspiration to fascist groups around the world. And if they lose, that's going to be a defeat for them. So this is part of what's going on here, and it's an important part.
Yeah, and that's not a narrative that you're going to hear. What you just said is not something you're going to hear specifically in Western media. Okay, let's take a look at another development here, Rustam, and that is the fact that you're looking at Finland and Sweden and the membership to NATO. Now, the question I have is not just these two countries, but the way that they are going about becoming a member, the incentive behind it. Do you think that there is some kind of scaremongering tactics that perhaps the U.S. is using for countries, European countries, like these two, that say, listen, if you don't join NATO, you could be next, something to that effect, in order not only to get weapon sales, but also obviously to have membership dues, because obviously we know they have to pay that to the NATO organization.
Well, you're right about that. Absolutely. In one point, when president was Mr. Donald Trump, he used to argue all the time, Europe and this rich nation of Europe do not contribute enough in all this defense apparatus, security issues in Europe. They do not pay enough. Why only Americans have to carry that way, this weight? And all these leads would be useful for United States. But I wouldn't deny natural fear of that nations in general atmosphere, because we have to admit majority of so-called civilized world, Western world, they portray that action of Russia as an aggression, and conversations like narrative, oh, you're the next, it's very much spread around the people who want to be scared. I mean, like, for example, some nationalists in Central Asia saying, oh, Kazakhstan going to be the next, you know, let's, like, whatever, move further away from Russia. Like in European nations saying, oh, next thing, like, Putin will take over Baltic republics. Of course, all of that seems to me as a very big exaggeration, and Russia doesn't have energy or drive for that. With Ukraine, it was a different story. It was a combination of two factors. Yes, Russia, Kremlin are considering armament of Ukraine and attempt to join the NATO as an existential threat. But it was especially painful and dangerous because, yes, Mr. Putin and a lot of people in Russia thinking, we grow up from the one root, these three nations, Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians. They're almost the same. They're almost one people, not exactly, but almost. So, and for them especially, they drive to the West. That's especially upsetting, treacherous thing, which has to be prevented by any cost. That's what contribute into that special military operation, mm-hmm. As a rationale, as a... Well, Finland and Sweden, Putin said, like, we don't really care about so much. I mean, it's bad, but we don't have anything against these nations, and we're not, like, yes, we do. We will create necessary step, move troops, whatever, create different bases in the border, but it's not where we're seeing dangers from. You could see, like, Ukraine with Azov, with a very powerful nationalistic rhetoric, with a suppressing Russian-speaking population in Donbass seems being much more dangerous to Kremlin. That's why it's a different story.
All right. So here we have Zelensky. Aside from the fact that it watches as countries join NATO within a span of a very short period of time, and aside from the fact that the EU is not prepared to have membership for it, it says Zelensky is saying a diplomatic solution is still possible. Diplomacy is the only way to end the war. Well, that's fine and dandy, but then you have the U.S. got another $40 billion just approved, and you still have the push for a military solution to come not only from the U.S., but obviously it leading the pack of NATO countries, NATO member countries. What is the story there? Do you think Zelensky, Jim Kavanaugh, wants some kind of negotiations now, or is it just, or is he just saying that, and he has to follow whoever is ordering him?
I think that Zelensky is not in control of his situation, and I think that you'd have to be silly to not think that he's every day on the phone and zooming call with his handlers in Washington and the CIA and American embassy, and he's under pressure from the right-wing fascists in Ukraine who do not want to settle this with Russia. Look, there was a diplomatic situation. This is the whole point. There was a diplomatic situation that was arrived at 8 years ago, and he was elected as president a couple of years ago to implement it, and he couldn't do it. And the United States doesn't want the war to stop, and the right-wing fascists don't want a war to stop. And his own senior advisor is on the record. You can see it on the internet saying a war with Russia is the only way we're going to get into NATO. So there is it's very difficult because the diplomatic solution, which is neutrality for Ukraine, no NATO, recognize Crimea as Russian and the Donbass republics as independent, is what Russia is after. And they're not going to stop. If they don't get that, they've lost. And if Ukraine gives that up, they have lost. This is quite clear. One side or the other of this is going to suffer a decisive defeat, and it cannot be hidden. And that's why, you know, this idea of a diplomatic solution is fine. There was one that could have worked, which would have kept the Donbass republics as autonomous regions within a unified Ukrainian state. That was destroyed by Ukraine.
All right, Rustam, looking at the goal that the U.S. has, as it has stated, even though we know that really the real goal, which it has also stated, being that it wants Russia to be militarily defeated, but it also wants Russia to have total devastation economically. Now, it's pushing really hard for that. In some ways, it has been successful. But when you take a look at how the Russian ruble, for example, is now the world's top performing currency for the year 2022, up 11% against the dollar, and you're still looking at EU countries buying the oil, and there are even talks of other commodities being added to the payment in ruble scheme, such as wheat, maybe, and meat. Do you think that U.S. then is defeated in its intentions when it comes to the sanctions regime against Russia?
You know, United States is a very powerful country, and it has a lot of capacities still. I wouldn't say it's United States is defeated. They could just became a little more practical and stop these attempts totally destroy Russia by trying to drone more and more Russian Ukraine into that war. That would be maybe more practical solution. But so far, the idea of like Reagan did to make Russia as bleed as possible during the war, and finally to destroy Russia economically and maybe politically as well, because obviously if Russia would lose, that would be not only the end of the Mr. Putin, that would be the end of contemporary political structure in Russia, and it could encourage different process of disintegration of Russia and so on. So what everybody is terrified in Russia to lose, because it could stimulate the process like happened in 1991 with the destruction of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
And so far we don't, I mean, like we see the first steps of American realism. For example, they refused to give some advanced weapons to Ukraine last time. Because they feel like it could be spread to the territory of Russian Federation, which already Ukraine trying to do. In this point, if Russia feels too desperate, it could use tactical nuclear weapon, and it could lead to world disaster, nuclear war. So I don't think United States are interested to have that sort All right. of outcome.
All right. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, Jim Kavanaugh from New York, the polemicist, political analyst and blogger, political analyst there at Russia Segodnya, Rustam Safrona from Moscow. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitakway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It's not the first time the monkeypox virus has been found in Britain, but now there are chains of transmission. We now present you an article written by Ian Sample. The piece is titled, Now Britons Have to Deal with It. What's going on in the UK with monkeypox? The person was sick when they boarded the plane. 5 days before leaving Nigeria for Britain, they noticed a rash that spread into a scattering of fluid-filled bumps. When the plane touched down on 4th of May, they wasted no time. The person attended hospital where doctors, alerted by their recent travel, immediately suspected monkeypox. The patient was isolated and a doctor, clad in full personal protective equipment, took a swab from a blister on their skin. Because monkeypox is listed as a high-consequence infectious disease, the situation moved fast. The sample was sent to Porton Down Science Park in Wiltshire, where the UK Health Security Agency's Rare and Imported Pathogens Laboratory swiftly ran a PCR test. This confirmed the infection, which the agency announced the next day on 7th of May. Sporadic cases of monkeypox are rare, but not new in Britain. In total, 7 cases have been recorded in 2018, 2019 and 2021, all linked to travel to Nigeria, where monkeypox is endemic. But as public health officials were soon to discover, this year was to be different. For the first time, doctors have uncovered chains of transmission in the community, not only in Britain, among people with no known links to travel. The UK has confirmed 20 cases, but more than 100 known or suspected cases are under investigation in the United States, Canada, France, Germany, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Sweden and Australia. Professor David Heyman, Distinguished Fellow at the Chatham House Global Health Programme and former Executive Director of the Communicable Diseases Cluster for the World Health Organization, WHO, said, "It's come into the UK, it's come into other countries, and now we have to deal with it and figure out what's going on." Monkeypox is a viral infection that most people shrug off. There are 2 forms of it. The more serious form is the Central African or the Congo strain. The latest cases involved a milder West Africa strain. Data from Africa suggests that about 1% of people with cases die. The concern is less around the impact on healthy people, but on the vulnerable, for example, those with weakened immune systems, and on the virus spreading in healthcare settings. Despite its name, the virus was first detected in macaques. Most human cases of monkeypox are believed to come from contact with other infected animals, such as rodents. Historically, transmission between humans has been limited. Infections sometimes spread in homes, but soon fizzle out. The virus spreads through large respiratory droplets, calling for prolonged or frequent face-to-face contact, or contact with body fluids such as saliva or skin lesions, either directly or through contaminated sheets, towels and other items. A week after confirming the first patient, the UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA, reported 2 more in a family in London, with no links to the first case. According to one doctor, the announcement on Saturday, 14th of May, was crucial because it carried images of monkeypox lesions. These were seen by specialists struggling to diagnose patients with unexplained rashes at health clinics. They immediately sent swabs to Porton Down in Wiltshire, which confirmed the cases as monkeypox. On Monday, 16th of May, the health agency confirmed 4 more cases, all men who appeared to have caught the virus in London. The increase in mostly unrelated cases prompted the UK's chief medical officers to send immediate advice to healthcare workers via the NHS Central Alerting System. It called on healthcare providers to ensure that they have sufficient personal protective equipment to assess the threat patients and noted that the smallpox vaccine, Imvanex, offered some protection against monkeypox if given soon after exposure. The vaccine is already being offered to healthcare workers and contacts of cases at high risk of infection, and the Department of Health has secured thousands of doses in case the outbreak grows. While public health experts rush to contain the outbreak, they warn against focusing on any particular group. One senior health specialist said this could easily have popped up in a different context. Asked why most cases are in men, Sir Ali Zumbler, a professor of infectious diseases and international health at University College London, urged people to avoid any prejudicial and unfair focus on any particular group. He said clusters of monkeypox could occur in any group in close contact with infected people. He added it was highly unlikely the clusters were due to any change in the virus. Dr. Meera Chand, Director of Clinical and Emerging Infections at UKHSA, said everyone should be alert to monkeypox symptoms. If you notice any unusual rashes or lesions consistent with monkeypox, please contact the National Health Service 111 or a health service, adding, a notable proportion of recent cases in the United Kingdom and Europe have been found in men, which is why we are particularly encouraging them to be alert on the symptoms. We are working to trace contacts of cases and offering vaccination where appropriate. And meanwhile, we are rapidly investigating how the virus is transmitting to understand why we are seeing this unusual outbreak. According to medical experts, monkeypox causes fever, body aches, enlarged lymph nodes, and eventually pox, or painful fluid-filled blisters on the face, hands, and feet. One of its versions is deemed deadly and kills up to 10% of people infected, but the version spreading presently in the United Kingdom is said to be milder, with a 1% fatality rate. The World Health Organization, WHO, is set to hold an emergency meeting on the outbreak of the rare virus, which is spreading in the European continent at an unprecedented speed. Health authorities of several countries are working with the World Health Organization to provide information on how the rare virus is spreading in different countries, after being unable to find the link between the initial case. In what Germany described as the largest ever outbreak in Europe, cases have been confirmed in at least 5 countries in Europe, including the United Kingdom, Spain, Portugal, Germany and Italy, as well as the United States, Canada and Australia. Germany's Armed Forces Medical Service said, with several confirmed cases in the United Kingdom, Spain and Portugal, this is the largest and most widespread outbreak of monkeypox ever seen in Europe. Meanwhile, health experts say the outbreak is unlikely to turn into a pandemic. Fabian Lendertz from the Robert Koch Institute said, however, it is very unlikely that this epidemic will last long. The cases can be well isolated by contact tracing, and there are also drugs and effective vaccines that can be used if necessary. As it has rarely spread outside of Africa, the series of cases in Europe, which are more than 100, has triggered concern among health authorities. According to the World Health Organization data, vaccines that were used to eradicate smallpox are up to 85% effective against monkeypox.